Hi, I'm Rick Sanchez. And, you know, I've been doing news now for, what, 30 years? Two different languages, all over the world and here in the U.S. I've interviewed four presidents, founded a billion-dollar business, and I believe news should be honest, direct, and impactful. And that's why we call this show Direct Impact. I want to start by showing you some pictures that are going to be hard to take your eyes off of, both because it's hard to look at them and because it's hard to look away. I mean, tell me as you look at some of these, see this? They almost look surreal, don't they? These are gang members, but not just any gang members. Many, if not most of them, belong to the notorious criminal gang Mara Salvatrucha, or MS-13 as they're often referred to. Credited with being one of the worst gangs in the Western Hemisphere. And you know what? They look it, huh? They look it. The government of El Salvador has been rounding them up, more than 60,000 of these characters, and they've built a prison that's going to house as many as 40,000 of them. Think about that for a minute. A prison for 40,000 criminals, mostly gang members, all who seem to look eerily similar. There are two things that I find striking about these images as I'm looking at them. Maybe you too. The tattoos and the crouch. I mean, look how they're shuttled from place to place in the most undignified way. They're not allowed to look up. It's as if they're so dangerous, and by the way, most would argue that they are, which is why they don't want them even making eye contact. And now let's talk about the exaggerated face and the neck and the body tattoos, which are in a strange and almost ironic way identifiable markers for these gang members. The tattoos are in some ways how they reportedly flaunt their membership in the gang. They self-identify, right? It's also a sign of their position or the hierarchy in the gangs. I didn't know that until I read up on it. These images are of masses of human beings in this almost movie-like setting, spaced so perfectly and handled so machine-like, so dehumanizing. It's as bizarre as anything we've ever seen. And the fact that the president of El Salvador, President Nayib Bukele, is committing to this, even if it means violating their constitutional rights, seems both, well, you know what, in some ways understandable, and in another way, kind of worrisome. But what makes this story even more interesting is the geopolitical angle, which comes with a history, really. And let me tell you why. The problem originates in a peculiar and very circular way in the United States, where many of these gang members come to and where they were once jailed and then deported. And how did they get to the U.S. to begin with? They migrated to the United States over the past several decades when their countries were racked by wars and coups and, most of all, outside interference from, I hate to say it, but from us, from Washington, in defense and for defense and multinational interests. Glaring example, I'll just give you one. The U.S. encouraged the civil war in Guatemala. We did, because we didn't like the country's democratically elected president. That goes back to the 1950s, but the war lasted until 1996, and in the 1980s, our government destabilized other countries like El Salvador for necessary reasons, our Pentagon would say, or our State Department would say. Combined, all of these wars led to the deaths of hundreds of thousands of people and massive migration moves. In the U.S., those immigrants, mostly poor and rural, had a hard time fitting in. Many joined gangs and were eventually sent to jails, where they became hardened criminals. Eventually, they were deported back to their countries as gang members. And that is where this vicious cycle really takes hold. Look, I take you through this. I explain this to you because I think, we think, it's important to always go beyond the headline and explain the genesis of these stories like this, because otherwise, you're never going to know. You just see it on the local news as some gang member killed another gang member. We do this to better understand how we got to this point. And I think it's important. You know who else thinks it's important? I want to introduce you to Luis Rodriguez, or Louis Rodriguez, as we would say here in the United States, as we all have our names anglicized or Americanized. He's an urban peace leader and often referred to as a gang interventionist. You know what? He cares about this. He's also a writer. He's a poet. He's a community activist and someone I've had the pleasure of talking to before. So I bring him so he can give us a real, you know, on the ground perspective on this situation. Luis, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you. My pleasure.
I guess I got to start with the pictures. When I first saw these videos, I'd never seen anything like it. It looks almost surreal. I use the word dehumanizing. What was your impression when you looked at these pictures of these of this roundup of all these guys in El Salvador and these prisons they're building for them?
Well, they're meant to demonize them. And there's a lot of things they do that's wrong. I'm not justifying gang members doing what they do. What people don't realize, though, is that these are human beings. Hmm. And human beings have great capacity. And I know because I've worked with gang members like them. I've actually worked with MS-13 and 18th Street. I've actually been to El Salvador for over 30 years. I've gone there working with them. I went to 10 prisons there. I've been to Guatemala. I spent a month in Honduras. I spent many years in Mexico. So I know the kids that are hurting, traumatizing, and traumatizing others. They need to be given a lot of care. To me, it's not about just putting them away. It's about giving them what I call the, it's tougher to care for me than tougher to be on, you know, just be a tough guy with them. You know, what Bukele has done is created a bigger gang. And they got prisons and they got more arms. That's all he's done. And so, yeah, you can fight these gangs with a bigger gang. It was done in the United States. You know, the first gangs in the United States, especially industrial United States, were Irish immigrants and Eastern European immigrants and Italian immigrants. They were the kids that were poor, didn't have anything. They came and worked in the worst, you know, jobs. And guess what happened? They became gangs, too.
But don't you have to? But I'm just thinking, as I'm listening to you say this, I'm thinking and I'm looking at these pictures. These guys, Luis, these guys look so hardened. I mean, it's almost like it gets to a point where I'm not sure. You say everybody is salvageable on, you know, God's earth. And I get that, you know, and I'm a Catholic and I understand. But does it get to a point where they're almost like impossible to be able to salvage? When I mean, look at these guys.
Well, that's a good question, and I think it needs to be answered, and I agree with that. I mean, I was in El Salvador in 2010. The violence went down 70%. They're talking about the violence going down like 58% now. The violence went down even further. Why? Because there was an effort to bring these gangs together, to have a peace, to get them to disarm, because I was witnessing when they were turning over all their guns. I also helped create, it wasn't just me, what others we called zonas de paz y seguridad. 12 zones were created in these barrios where MS-13 and 18th Street could come together. They could do gardening, they could learn skills, they did murals, they could work together. It actually helped, but it was completely undermined by the U.S. government because I saw what happened. The U.S. government put this thing, you can't do this, you can't work with gangs, you can't negotiate with gangs. And then the Salvadorian government at the time, it wasn't Bukele, at the time, destroyed it all. All the zonas were gone, and it went back to warfare.
You just said something interesting. If other solutions could be tried, try to get to them before they become hardened. Try and get to the younger ones. You know, teach them new skills. And yet, it's always seemed to me, and I've always believed, that we should put more money in recreation, in cultural development, in education. It seems like you and I live in a country now where everything is about a police action and militarization. And I think maybe that has to do with money. I don't know. It seems like some people think it's more efficient, easier, and certainly more profitable to just stick them in jail than it is to help them. Right.
But just think about what's happening with this big prison, this huge prison in El Salvador, the largest in America, apparently. 40,000 people can be held there. That's what I hear. Uh-huh. They're going to be held for 30 years at least, maybe their whole lives. Let's say it's $20,000 per person, because in the United States and in California, it's like $46,000 to hold a person, an inmate in prison.
For one year.
We've had up to 170,000 in California. up to 170,000. So what happens in El Salvador when you have to pay 20,000? Let's say it's not quite 40,000. 20,000, yeah. It's billions of dollars to keep people locked up away from the, and you know what? They're still human beings. Something's going to happen with them. And that's what happened in California. We created the segregated housing units. We created the super maxes that are now, they're being relooked at because they actually did more damage. But people came out more worse than when they came in.
I see where you're going here, though, and I'm just doing the math in my head, obviously. If it costs $46,000 minimum to keep a person right. in prison in California, if you had from the very beginning, and I know this is crazy because it's a lot to give them, but given yeah. them the $46,000 and created a job, yeah. an opportunity for them, I don't know.
Call me crazy. But giving them a job.
They yeah. probably would yeah. not have become gang members, or maybe wouldn't have become. I guess I'm hoping. Yeah. You know.
Yeah. Well, we used to say, and this came out of the '92 uprising in Los Angeles, when Bloods and Crips were actually uniting with Mexicans. People don't know that part. They only know about the violence. They don't know that people were trying to get together, and they had a statement: "Give us the hammers and the nails, and we will rebuild our communities." That to me is a powerful statement. I mean, nobody took them up on it. Nobody gave it. Okay, can we build our roads? Can we build new housing? Can we build better schools? Give us the skills. And I'll tell you, it worked with me. I was a gang member. I got a book called Always Running, best-selling book here. I got another book called Calls You Back about what I went through. My own son was in a gang in Chicago. He spent almost 15 years in prison there. We're both doing good right now. We're helping others. We change people's lives. And I've been doing this for many years. And I remember in the early 70s when we were getting hardcore gang members, because you're not going to tell me that these kids in MS-13, they're hardcore. But I've met hardcore people all over.
I've got to say
and we
this.
Can change their lives. And
listen, yeah, go ahead. You're going to think less of me for saying this, and I apologize if you do. But I have to say it, because I think it's something everybody else would think when they watch this. I'm looking at you, Luis. I don't see gang member. I don't see past gang member. You look like a decent guy, somebody's dad, maybe somebody's granddad. When I look at these guys with those tattoos on their faces.
Yeah, well, if you had seen me when I was 16, you would have seen the same thing. I don't have tattoos on my faces. But all those tattoos came. Okay, let's just go back to the Chicano, which I am. The old Pachucos were rounded up in the 30s and 40s. People forget about that. They were rounded up and put in special Chicano tanks. There used to be a Chicano tank in the county jail. Yeah.
Mexican-Americans. It means Mexican-Americans in Los Angeles.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And they were rounded up. And by the 50s, they created the first and largest prison gangs that became quite active in criminal activity. They became bigger than all the things that people couldn't imagine. They put them in San Quentin and thought, oh, we're going to hide them in San Quentin. And they actually became stronger. They created shoes. And they actually became stronger. Then other prison gangs, other racial minorities, everybody was creating prison gangs. It got worse and worse. And the Salvadorians, Guatemalans, and others that came as migrants during the wars ended up in those barrios. MS-13 didn't start in El Salvador. It started in L.A. 18th Street was a Chicano gang for 20-some years before the Salvadorians and others got into 18th Street. In other words, we're just continuing that. Again, it's a cycle that gets worse and worse. Yeah. And now you go to California, they're all got tattoos in their faces. It's worse. In Central America, you see it all the time. But I work in the prison system for 40 years. I go among them. They're all there. What have we done to make things worse? You know what I'm saying? Even when I was in a gang, things were bad. We had guns, people, drive-bys. I lost 25 friends by the time I was 18 in the 60s and early 70s. And things have gotten worse. And I think has to do with being tough on crime, putting people away, dehumanizing people, not providing rehabilitation, not providing real resources, not giving them the hammers and nails as a metaphor and rebuild their communities. This is why I think things have gotten bad.
Well, and you mentioned that vicious cycle. I want to address that. Let's do this. We're going to take a break. But when we come back, I want to address that vicious cycle, because that gets us into a conversation about our own foreign policy, which is perhaps the genesis of much of this. We're talking with Luis Javier Rodriguez, real firsthand knowledge about this gang situation that we're talking about. You stay there. By the way, I have a podcast where I, as a journalist, as a Latino, as an entrepreneur, I tell my story and I share with you what I've learned, how to succeed, how to grow, how to fail. It's called the Rick Sanchez Podcast. I invite you to check it out, and I will see you there. But when we come back, let's go to that point. How is it that gang members in America who now end up going back when they're deported to their country, who end up recruiting new gang members, how that actually started in the 50s and 60s and 70s and 80s with our foreign policy in those countries, countries in Latin America. I'll take you through it. Stay right there. We'll be right back.
So what we've got to do is identify the threats that we have.
It's crazy.
Confrontation, let it be an arms race.
Who is on offense? Very dramatic development.
I personally am going to resist.
I don't see how that strategy will be successful.
Very critical time.
Time to sit down and talk.
Welcome back. I'm Rick Sanchez. You know, one of the most amazing angles to this story is that the same immigrants who arrived in the United States as children and are now recruiting and training other children in places like El Salvador and others to become gang members, just like them. And think about it. Those children immigrate to the U.S., are jailed here, deported, then sent back to their countries where they recruit the other children. Talk about a vicious cycle, right? Talking to us once again is Luis Javier Rodriguez, who can speak to this from real experience, from a life well lived through some hardship. What do you make of that? I mean, I mentioned earlier, you know, what we did in Guatemala. I wish we hadn't done it, but you know, foreign policy is a funny thing, and you can always go through history and find mistakes. But you know, our intervention during the Reagan years in El Salvador, in Nicaragua, in Honduras, countries that we sort of destabilized. I'm not going to argue politics here. Some would say we needed to do it. Some would say we didn't. But whatever it is, the reason we did it, it had a blowback. And that blowback was we ended up with young boys here who had no fathers, who came from those disastrous situations, and then they became delinquents. And from delinquents, they kind of grew into hardened criminals. How does that happen?
Well, they're refugees from war, which is bad enough. But then they end up in another war zone, the inner cities of America, which has Chicano gangs, has Bloods and Crips, has gangs out of Chicago, wherever they landed. But let's say just L.A. They got very close to the Chicano barrios. They were living in barrios that were Chicanos. They've been there for already 2, 3, 4 generations.
Yeah.
And not that all Chicanos are gang members, but the gang members are hard, and they've been there a long time. They became integrated in those gangs. Here's what happens, though. In 92, there's a peace accord, finally, in El Salvador. But then the U.S., under a Democratic president, because I don't think this is a Democratic or Republican problem, it's a problem for both of them, mm-hmm. decides to deport them. These are kids that were raised here. Their tattoos came from here. I was in El Salvador in the 80s. They didn't have tattoos. They didn't have that kind of gang life. They had their people, their criminals, but nothing like us. We deported a whole culture from LA streets down there with nothing, no skills or nothing.
They didn't even speak Spanish, right? They didn't even speak. Yeah. When I was a journalist, when I was a correspondent at CNN, I was once assigned to cover that, and I took it upon myself. I called the folks with immigration who do this kind of thing, and I said, I want to be on the plane. I want to go. And they said, well, okay, you can go. You're a journalist. So they took me on the plane. I was startled to find out many of the people who were on those planes and being sent back to these countries. I went with them to I believe it was Honduras, Tegucigalpa. I remember they didn't speak Spanish. And when they let them go from the plane, they went there and they said, they were Americans.
Yeah. And they were hounded, they were looked badly, but then congregated together, they began to become cohesive. And because the countries are so poor, all these countries you're talking about, Honduras, Guatemala, El Salvador, they're so poor that they had a world that they can work in. And even, not all of them, but they can apply their criminal knowledge they got from California prisons. And that's what you see the expansive of it. I was there in 93. I was talking to, these guys were barely putting the tattoo face things. By the time I came back in the early 2000s, they were all, now they were cohesive. Now they recruited new kids that were lost. Poor kids had nowhere to go. They looked up to these LA guys. These guys were tough and tattooed, and everybody looked up to them because these kids were all alienated. They didn't know what to do, where to go, and then they began to recruit large numbers. The deportations that we did impacted these countries without sending these kids properly helped or cared for.
Yeah, you know? And I get it, because then they went there and then they recruit others who aren't in the gang life, but they teach them the gang life. They get hardened. Sometimes they get deported, or they immigrate to the United States because they have clean records. Nobody knows who they are.
Yeah, yeah.
They come here and they get arrested, and it just continues.
It's worse and worse, and then they get deported again. You know, so we create, and I want to talk about the U.S. policy here. Okay, we understand Salvador has a hand in it. Everybody's got a hand in it, breaking down our families, poverty. But our policies have contributed to all these, to the violence. Yeah. And then I was there when we were trying to change that. And the U.S. government's thing is you can't negotiate with gangs, you can't help gangs, can't do nothing. They even brought Rudy Giuliani to El Salvador and Guatemala, where he said, put them all away. What Bukele is doing is Giuliani's plan. I don't know if people know this. It's Giuliani came over. They paid him millions of dollars. When I was going to El Salvador, I paid myself. Nobody gave me money. But they paid him millions of dollars to come in there and say, let's put them all away. And Bukele is doing exactly what
this is a policy that we tend to show in this country too often, where we just don't want to talk to people. We'd rather, for some reason, we'd rather have enemies than develop ways to get along. You know, whether it's the China policy, the way we treat Russia, the wars we get into in the Middle East. I mean, we could go down the list of things that and here in our own country, the way we often use the fist rather than the open hand. Now, I get it, too. There's times when you need to use the fist. When someone's a piece of you-know-what, you need to put them away, and they really are bad. But if you make that decision too early, you create the possibility that you're making the problem worse. Although there's a part of me that I have to ask you this. My father passed away last year, and I still miss him to this day. But I remember he always told me, he said, son, I grew up rough. I only have a fourth grade education. I was shining shoes for a living in my country, in Cuba. And I had bad guys all around me all the time. I saw guys smoking marijuana and doing drugs and stuff. But I never did drugs. I never smoked marijuana. And I always... Why, if my dad could have figured that out, can't these other people figure it out? What's the allure of gang life that gets to these kids? And why couldn't they figure out a way to avoid it?
Let's just make clear that most Salvadorians in the U.S. and in El Salvador are good, law-abiding, hardworking.
Of course, yeah.
So we're talking about, and they raise their kids, even with no money, or they raise their kids the best they can. We're talking about kids that fell through the cracks. What can we do to stop those cracks? Because I fell through the cracks. None of my brothers and sisters grabbed the gang. My mother and father worked hard. Why did I fall through the crack? You know, and I've written books about it, why some guy like me would do that. And then also how some guy like me could get out of it. You know, and you mentioned how I look pretty good. I'll tell you a funny story. I went to a prison in North Carolina, 200 young men, all black. I walked there because they said, hey, this guy was a former gang member. He got all this book. They looked at me. I walked in through there and they laughed at me because I looked like the janitor or their uncle. They even said, "Looks like my uncle," or whatever. They were laughing at me, but I came in there. I walked in there because they didn't think I was a heavy duty gangster. But once I went through, I walked up, I started telling my story. I started telling what I went through. I started reading my poetry. They would stop and they listen. And by the time I got through, they gave me a standing ovation.
Wow.
Because they understand people can change. I look this way now because I've changed for many, many years. My son did 15 years in prison. You should see him. He looks like a real positive young man. He wasn't that way when he first got into prison. People do change, and they even looked at it. I work with a guy that did 30 years in prison for murder. He was a shot caller for one of the big gangs here in L.A. Now he's going into juvenile halls and helping kids. They gave him permission because he's teaching them poetry and drumming. He's changed their lives. I know it could happen. And that's what I'm, that's my story. We need to do more of that. Just not enough money, not enough support. There's just not enough, but when we do it, it works.
Why don't we do it? I mean, is there, we mentioned this earlier, and I'm not sure I got a proper response for it, but do you think it's greed? Do you think that people make too much money on prisons for us to do it any other way?
And going back to even El Salvador, how much money would it take to keep somebody in prison? There's a whole industry here. California created a huge industry. I'm not saying just California, all the states, but California led most of the big, huge, giant mass incarceration system. And now we're doing in California, now we're trying to change that. We're trying to reform the prison. We're trying to get people out of there. We're trying to help. I'm not saying it's going perfect, but we're trying to do something.
Luis Javier Rodriguez, thanks so much for taking the time to take us through this very personal experience and this part of the story. Thank you once again.
It's my honor. Thank you.
Before we go, I want to remind you that why we do interviews like this, we think they're different. We have a mission. It's really pretty simple. We want to de-silo the world. I mean, we've got to stop thinking in terms of this and that and little boxes, you know. You got to be on the right or the left or this side or that side. Truths don't live in boxes. Truths live everywhere, right? I'm Rick Sanchez. I'll be looking for you right here, where I hope to provide a direct impact.